Welcome to the Lob Podcast, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to the Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and once again, we're in the centre circle, and once again, I'm so excited already. Once again, we're adding to our newfound Panini series, as Stephen Scraggers has named it, where we've managed to line up another of our Panini stickers from our childhood, but more about the special guest in just one moment. But first of all, two co-hosts for tonight. First of all, the aforementioned Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, another swapsie for the playground tonight.
This is excellent. I think, you know, if we can work our way through every page of the Panini album from, I don't know, say 84, 85 or something like that, then that would be perfect. But yeah, this is just absolutely epic.
And obviously, you know, we're here, well, once we introduce the guest, but we're here partly, you know, just to talk to the man, talk about his career, talk about his experience, but obviously to talk about his book as well, which we were lucky enough to get a copy of slightly earlier than maybe others did. But it's a fascinating read.
It is, because it, you know, it just opens the door on an era that we're still transfixed by. You know, you always said before about being hardwired to kind of like the football of your youth and it being the yardstick for everything else. And I think more so for us is that football, certainly since the inception of the Premier League, and it's that saturation of football, whereas, you know, back in the 80s when we were kids, it felt like football felt like, you know, there was an occasion. It felt like something tangible and something special, whether that was clicking through a turnstile or getting to watch the limited amount of football we had on the television. It just felt special, and that, you know, in a way that it doesn't now. I'm not saying that football is rubbish now. You know, it's a different kind of good now. You know, back then, you know, it was just awe-inspiring, and being a carefree kid, you know, this was just the era.
It is. And second co-host is Mr. Aidan Williams. First of all, Aidan, welcome.
Hi there. Really looking forward to it. Again, yeah, you talk about Panini and all that. Sorry, Stu.
No, that's exactly what I was going
to
say.
I've got to say, players like this one, they're worth far more when it comes to swaps, because they're more talented, more gifted, and they're the ones you wanted.
It is, and it's still...
You would have to give away five or six to get this one.
You would. Oh, yeah.
I guess even now, when, you know, we've done these for a little while now, guys, and we've been lucky with who we've had, but I still go back and still have to pinch myself a little bit that we're chatting with, like we say, somebody that we swapped in the playground. It still seems so surreal, the sort of lucky situation that we find ourselves in, Aidan.
Oh, doesn't it ever? And as Steve was saying, it's the era, you know, all the moments that come to mind when we're thinking of the certain games and certain moments. And our guest today is at the heart of so many fine moments and incidents through that time that, you know, just the mere mention of his name brings it all back to mind in a flood of white and orange and some really, really special times and special moments.
Obviously, us three could clearly ramble on all day about Panini stickers and swapsies, but that's not what people are tuning in for. So, you know, I guess we should come to the special guest. And tonight's guest is 436 league appearances for Luton Town, 50 plus goals, 3 appearances for England as a coach, league titles in the US, has worked with David Pleat at Tottenham and at Sheffield Wednesday. And is probably his most important role, and we'll come to this, and this is obviously just my opinion, but most important role is the introduction of the Rooney Rule from the NFL in America across to English football, and making English football aware of a ruling that has had massive implications in North America, and will hopefully continue to have those implications over here. We're also here to talk about his wonderful book, which is something else we'll get into, called Love of the Game. It is Mr. Ricky Hill. Ricky, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Stuart. Good evening. Good evening, Aidan. Good evening, Stephen. How are you all?
Oh, so much better for your presence, Ricky.
Absolutely. Very good.
Too kind.
Ricky, there's so much that I'm sure we all want to chat about, that we all want to ask you. So many facets to your career, so many sort of tiny moments in the grand scheme of a career, so many big moments that impact on an entire lifetime, I guess, which, you know, which we will get to. But, you know, we opened with your book, you know, Love of the Game. And I suppose, first of all, what's the book about? You know, is it the biography? Is it, you know, we've read it, but for people who are listening, you know, is it just an overview of your career, or do you see it as much more than that? But secondly, and a question that I like to ask people is, why now? You know, why, when people choose to write their biography or choose to write their memoirs, you know, I'm always interested in the time that they choose to pick to either write it or to release it.
Okay, sure. Good questions. I'll take the second one first. Why now? The now came around, I guess, possibly 3 years ago. I was in Chicago. I was on the coaching assignment. I've been away from home. My family, my wife, my children were in the UK, but I'd been over there doing some work with a soccer club in regards to some coach educational work. And I got a phone call in the middle of the night, and it was from Jason Roberts's uncle, Otis Roberts, whose other uncle on the other side was Sewer Regis, Jason Roberts's nephew. So, and Otis said to me, Big C's passed away. And it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was like, obviously in the USA. And it hit me really hard, and I cried myself to sleep, and, you know, I thought about things. When I got up, and I thought, wow. So none of us are immortal. It can happen to any of us at any time. I'm away from home. I'm away from my loved ones. If something was to happen to me now, how would I be remembered? You know, would I be remembered just from my football perspective and my career? Or do I have to say things so people know a little bit more about me? Because during my career, I was pretty private. I wasn't one of those guys that was full on. I didn't seek publicity. I wasn't very good on that side of things in regards to self-promotion. But I thought, I do have quite an interesting story to share. Post my professional career, or pre my professional career, I should say, during my professional career, and then post my professional career. So in all those aspects, I thought, well, I've got to put it down on paper. I'm one of the first generation black coaches on influx black players on influx in the 1970s. I'm now one of the first generation black coaches on influx again, or on mass, moving forward into our secondary career. So there's a lot of things that I felt that needed to be shared. And I felt that this moment in time would be a great opportunity for me to do that. So I started writing the book, you know, a month or so later, just in my own mind, going through little stages of my childhood and why I was attracted to the game initially and how that developed and the opportunities that I might or might not have received due to the racism in particular of the time in the 60s and 70s in the UK, which my parents were subjected to via being part of the Windrush generation. So all those things encapsulated and put together, I thought would make a compelling read. Then going into obviously my professional environment, and then after my professional life as a player, how I was going to go and make a life or a secondary career as a coach stroke manager. And I think meeting AD, again, I mean, I've known Adrian Durham for over a decade, but I got together about a couple of years ago, and we were just out talking, socializing, and I mentioned that I was doing the book. He said, oh, Rick, I'd love to help you do it. So I said, well, brilliant. So what I had down, I passed it over to AD. You know, we brainstormed. He came back and asked me to put things that he would want, you know, which would be interesting for the fans and the readers to see and hear my thoughts and things. And I'm, you know, really proud and pleased with the outcome of it all. And obviously, without Adrian's assistance, I don't think it would be to my satisfaction today.
That's very magnanimous of you. It's Aidan, I'll come to you first. We did a podcast called two-part with the History Boys, and we talked about football's potential to educate. And I don't want to go into that just yet, but what I do want to say is, you know, Ricky's book is very much, it's not just a football book. It's almost a social study of football and what life was like for players in the 80s, but also for black players in the late 70s and early 80s. It very much is a book of its time in that it is a very honest recalling of what it was like as a player back then.
Absolutely. And some of the things that Ricky mentions in the book, you know, it's the kind of things we've heard from, you know, people like John Barnes and other players of the era. But, you know, each time you read the examples of everyone's personal experiences, because everyone's experiences are slightly different, or they, you know, they, it impacts on them possibly in different ways. But, you know, each time you read these experiences, it just strikes home again just how awful and how tough a time it was and must have been for, as Ricky says, the first generation of more black players coming through. You know, Ricky mentions about Albert Johansson from earlier days as being an inspiration for him. And he was very much on his own, I guess, in that era. Whereas Ricky was coming through, there were obviously more, but the incidents were numerous and horrific. And some of the ones that Ricky talks about, and I think it's the way. And you talk about the education, the sort of social history aspect of it, Stuart, and that's really, really interesting, and how that comes across in the book. And it comes across in sort of things about, you know, people saying, oh, well, Ricky's manager at the time saying, well, it went in one ear and out the other for Ricky. He was like, well, as Ricky says, how does he know? He didn't ask you. How does he know what impact that had on you and how that affects you? Because I can't see any way that it doesn't affect you negatively, for all the way that, you know, these things have been heard before, sure, but it doesn't make it any better. It makes it no easier to handle. And having thousands of people shouting abuse at you, I just can't even comprehend what that must feel like, let alone trying to do your job while that's going on. So, yeah, you know, to have your own manager say something like that shows, I don't know, a lack of understanding, a lack of empathy, but also a lack of a desire to actually find out, well, what did Ricky think of it? How did it impact on Ricky? You know, it's reading things like that in this that, you know, that adds an extra dimension to something that, yes, we know about, and yes, it's horrific, but it's finding out the sort of the background and the extras, the extra bits of information that we might not necessarily know, that things like that, that reading through, how well told it is in here as well, and coming through. So it's not just a case of, yes, got this, got spotted at school and then worked hard as a footballer and made my way. You know, there's so many more layers to this, and it's all the more intriguing. But you're absolutely right. The sort of social aspect of it it's disturbing, it's horrific, but it's important, and it's really, really important. Because we come on to the sort of coaching aspects later on. And Ricky's already described it as being the first generation of players, and now he's part of the first generation of managers. And that's, you know, it's true, but it's ridiculous, because that's the time difference in between from one to the other, for it to be the same people, is absolute madness, really, but it's absolutely true. So learning, educating and informing about, you know, the experiences of players like Ricky at that time is so important and so vital to sort of enhance the understanding and enhance the education of everybody. You know, people can be very well informed, but unless you know the background, unless you've experienced it yourself, which obviously the likes of you or I, Stu and Steve, aren't going to experience in that way. So, you know, the best we can do is try to understand. And, you know, the way it's been written in here, the way it's been explained, and the experiences and the whole questioning of, well, yeah, how does he know? He never asked. That kind of assumption that, you know, he's a footballer, therefore he'll get on with it, as though it's any other kind of abuse, just somebody shouting, oh, you're rubbish, you know, what are you doing playing here? You know, that it's equating it to being that kind of abuse, and it's not. It's so not, and it's so much worse.
Stephen, you know, you're obviously, you know, everybody knows, passionate Liverpool fan. And I want to, obviously, you know, Ricky's, you know, playing career at Luton, you know, was part of that excellent Luton Town that sort of came up in the early to mid 80s and, you know, obviously culminates in the League Cup win. But I guess as a season ticket holder at Anfield, you know, you must have seen Ricky a few times, Grace Anfield and performances, and you know, your perspective of him as a fan of an opponent, I guess. You know, you're not a Luton Town fan, you're a Liverpool fan, but your perceptions of him as a child, watching him at Anfield.
Yeah, I mean, education is the word again. You know, as a Liverpool fan, I was brought up to appreciate, you know, opposing players. There will be players that will come along and you think, you know, I'd love to see them in a red shirt. And Ricky was one of those. You know, I loved, you know, seeing, you know, you'd tick off as the season went along certain players that come through town and you know, they're out there on the pitch. And I remember that Ricky goes into it, that really kind of like wild 3-3 draw when there was three different goalkeepers for Luton, despite the fact that, you know, this was the era where you only had one substitute. So yeah, it's two out of three. Always something brilliantly, you know, fantastic about that era when an outfield player had to go and go. It's these little things that have been lost from modern football that you just don't see anymore. But, you know, I remember that game very, very well. And yeah, you know, Ricky and that Luton side caught the imagination somewhat, you know, as a child of the 80s. And as a Liverpool fan, I'm not meant to like those plastic pitches, for instance. But, you know, the certain guilty pleasures of the 1980s for me is that, you know, I always had a little bit of a kind of like, when anyone had slagged the plastic pitches off, I'd be like, yeah, they're terrible. But actually love the bounce of the ball and being watching, you know, watching it on the telly and stuff like that. But yeah, you know, Ricky was just wonderful to watch. You know, John Barnes was another, you know, absolutely, you know, loved certain players and you gravitate towards them because it's the style of play and just the relationship a player has with a ball, I think it comes down to. And there's always something, whatever it is, whatever type of football fan you are, whether it's a crunching central midfielder that you're drawn to, whether it's the goalkeepers that catch the imagination. You know, for me, it was always the players that just had that wonderful relationship with the ball, and Ricky was definitely one of those.
I mean, as Stephen said there, Ricky, you know, there are games that fans tick off, and you know, you are so inextricably linked with Luton Town. You know, I guess you know, it's what everybody must want to talk to you about. You know, your career at Luton. You know, and I guess that, you know, clearly it defines your playing career. But when I started reading the book, I didn't realise how early you'd started playing for, you know, 17 into the first team, you know, and like you say, you know, first generation black player, you know, and you really were, you know, one of those very early sort of pioneers, you know, black players. You know, you talk about Laurie Cunningham, Cyril Regis, you know, there's Viv Anderson, you know, you are right there with, you know, with those guys. But I didn't appreciate what a young age, and as Aidan was saying there, you know, the strength of character and strength of mind it must have taken as a youngster at Luton, making your way in professional football, you know, we can't appreciate it. It must be so difficult. But I guess making your way as a black player, you would have had extras to deal with. But, you know, those early days at Luton, I guess the football was everything that you focused on.
Absolutely, Stuart. Firstly, thank you, Steve and Aidan, for such glowing praise and words. I don't know if I'm worthy, but I appreciate it anyway. It's nice for an old man to hear those things and the memories to go.
Ricky, you were definitely worthy. Definitely.
Appreciate it, Steve. But in regards to the time at Luton, when I got into the side or the youth team, I think my main ambition as from a young child was to become a professional footballer. And I had no idea how that was going to happen. I hadn't seen many people that looked like me become a professional. I hadn't seen many black players from where I grew up become involved in professional football clubs. I don't remember many that were invited for trials who were a couple of years older than me or 3 years, 4 years older. I don't remember many black players that were renowned as quality players ever being invited to Queen's Park Rangers or West Ham or Chelsea. So it was a daunting task for me to actually think, well, I want to play football. I think I'm a good player, but I don't know where, I don't know how, and I don't know if I'll ever be spotted. And by chance, I was out in Hitchin and our school team played out there when we played well, and David Pleat, Danny Bergara and Roma Crowan were the coaching staff at Luton at the time. And they were watching three of their players, assessing them to become apprentices the following year. And we showed up well. I was invited for trials with two of my colleagues, and it kind of snowballed from there. And you know, once I got my foot into the door, it was all I ever dreamt about and all I ever wanted. I then ensured that I worked harder than anyone, as your parents always told you, you know, work as hard as you can, do the best you can. And if you then happen to fail, it won't be for the want of trying. And when growing up as a black child, we were always told that, you know, even if you work twice as hard as someone else, you may not still get the opportunity. So make sure you put your heart and soul into anything that you do. Luton was a fantastic environment for me. It was second division at the time, a club that was just about to go into administration as well. And I joined in November, and Peter Anderson actually was sold to Antwerp for 40,000. And that enabled the club to continue afloat and not be going to administration by all accounts. So, but Harry Haslam had said when I signed my apprenticeship form that within 5 months, said to my mum, Ricky would be a professional, because my mum was adamant she didn't want me to go into the professional game. She was very big on academics, and my sister and my brother had gone on before me, my older siblings, and they'd achieved fairly well results at university. And she worried whether if I'd get injured, what would happen to me then, or if I was released at 18. And my brother urged her to let me go because he felt that I'd be good enough and not have the problem. So at 17 years old, Harry had some call in the office and said, remember when I promised mum that you'd be professional in 5 months' time? Here you are. And he offered me the contract. I signed the contract. The race element at that stage, I wasn't really aware of anything so much. It was really cosmopolitan. Luton was a really multicultural town. Didn't have any issues growing up, really. Growing up in Cricklewood, likewise, which again was very multicultural. Lots of different races, different cultures, and we all got on okay. Where the race element kicked in the football was one of my first away games at Burnley. And I went there and I was the only black player on the field. Out of the 22 that were out there, there was possibly no other black person within the ground. And they saw me as a target because I was different. I was 17 years old and 6 months, I guess it would be by that time. And they'd made up a song for me at 3 o'clock when I came out. Three quarters of the crowd was singing that song. They changed it. They did another version of a different song, all targeting me, all using racial slurs against me and derogatory comments. And I looked at my teammates, you know, just to look what they did, and they had this sadness in their eyes. I had a look of sadness and helplessness. And I thought, you know what? I'm here. This is my dream. I'm good at what I do. They're only trying to put me off my game so that their team can play against 10 people. Let me just try and continue and play the best I can. And it worked out okay on that day. Managed to score the winning goal and silence the crowd for a little while. And it was something, though, that I guess I didn't expect, but I wasn't worried per se, because I felt, yes, I am black. And I always knew that I would be different. If I made a mistake on the field, I was easily identified. You know, if I gave the ball away cheaply, someone say wouldn't have to look at my number of my shirt. They say it's a black player. So I always, in my mind, trained myself to say, well, okay, I'm going to be as polished as I can be. I'm not going to give the ball away recklessly. I'm still going to play my game, still try to be offensive, still try to dominate as best as I can, still try to produce moments of skill that will make the supporters happy, give them something that would be lasting memories forever. And I think my biggest strength at that stage, even as a young player, was the fact that I was not afraid to make mistakes. And I had that kind of amnesia whereby it wouldn't bother me. I wouldn't dwell on it. I would understand what happened. I would correct it in my mind, ensure that it didn't happen again, and just keep moving and keep playing the best that I can possibly do. So that's how I kind of introduced myself to the professional environment.
Already, Aidan, listening, you know, this is a real... education, I think, is probably the right word. And as you mentioned earlier, we can't even begin, and it would be churlish to try and even begin to try and understand it. But I still struggle to wrap my head around a 17-year-old being exposed to that environment in what is essentially a professional industry.
Well, it's got to be a terrifying experience as a 17-year-old anyway. Right. Let's be honest, you know, every other issue aside, being a 17-year-old professional footballer in one of your first games, playing away from home, hostile crowd, regardless, that's a stressful situation for everybody. So yes, to add these extra horrible things on top of that, you know, the weight, the burden, I guess is the word, the burden that must have left is, I mean, it's impossible to understand, but it, you know, you can try and picture the scene and try and empathize, and all you can say is that, well, you know, I'd be terrified anyway, looking exactly the same as everybody else. So just add on all those extra layers on top of that, and it's incredible to actually have the sort of strength of will, the strength of character, determination within. To be able to, I don't want to say block it out, because obviously it all registered, so it's not blocked out. It's all been heard, and as Ricky said, all his teammates heard it and reacted to it as well. So, you know, it's not that it's blocked out. It can't be. It's too overwhelming for that. But to actually then still be able to have the focus, the determination, and the strength of character, I guess, to ignore it in the moment, and actually maybe it's a fuel to show them, you know, to show them that you won't be daunted, you won't be put off, and to actually then perform well, that just makes it all the more incredible to me, to actually have that strength of will. I think, you know, put me in a professional game at age 17, and I'd have probably just been so terrified I'd have wanted to run away from the ball rather than accept it. So, you know, well, that's probably why, and one of the many reasons I wasn't a professional footballer. But, you know, it's incredibly impressive to actually be able to do that as a teenager, away from home, being, as Ricky said, probably the only black person in the whole stadium. You know, you're noticeable, you stand out, and to put that aside in, you know, as I say, not ignoring it, but to put it aside in the moment, to be able to perform is absolutely astonishing. And yet, I guess this then going forward becomes something that, you know, it was a surprise possibly to Ricky the first time, the sort of degree, the level of it. But going forward, that would become, you know, depressingly normal, depressingly commonplace. And it's an experience that Ricky and so many others will have had to put up with and just perform anyway, regardless of it, knowing that there's very little you can do about it. And, you know, that's horrific, but it's all the more, the degree of respect for people like Ricky and his contemporaries, and you've named several of them already, of being able to do what they did in the face of all of that is just all the more remarkable and impressive.
I mean, I absolutely agree, Aidan, and it's something, Stephen, that, you know, you don't want to sort of talk about, you know, it's a common phrase that standing on the shoulders of giants, but, you know, people like Ricky, like Cyril, like Laurie Cunningham, Brendan Batson, you know, those players, you know, what they went through is what's allowed players like Raheem Sterling, Rashford, you know, to sort of, you know, to go, not to go beyond what they achieved, but what, you know, what players like Ricky did is facilitate a path whereby then, you know, not only the acceptance as footballers, but also the acceptance, and certainly with Rashford, that voice of reason and that actual, you know, that is actually making the nation sit up and take notice. And if you go back to, you know, to Ricky's time as a young player, like Marcus Rashford, which is in our lifetime that we can remember, and, you know, you think back to then, it would almost be unheard of that would happen. But it's because of Ricky's generation of players that players like Marcus Rashford have the platform that they now have, which is better for football, better for the country, better for young people, better for the education of people in this country and around the world.
Completely. You know, Ricky and his generation of players, of black players, you know, made racism, you know, front and centre. You know, they created a schism of such, of thinking. You know, you had on one hand those who were intolerant, and the more intolerant they were, the more they stood out as being unreasonable, of being frankly disgusted. And then on the other hand, you had you know, another set of thinkers who were kind of like sat there saying that it wasn't right. This is not correct. This is not the way it is. You know, at Liverpool wasn't, you know, a particularly great place to go to for black players. John Barnes has been on record as stating that he was booed in a Watford shirt, you know, the monkey chants and everything. I remember those games, you know, and being confused by it as a kid, utterly confused by it, because it wasn't on my radar. You know, I didn't grow up in a racist family. You know, everyone was just, you know, another person. You know, I was always taught that, you know, if you didn't take to a person, it was because of the way they thought, not the way they looked, not the ethnicity or where they came from, the way they spoke or anything like that. It was just the way that they thought, what the thought processes were, you know, the beliefs, you know. So these intolerances started to stand out like a sore thumb. You know, I've mentioned it before, the arrival of John Barnes at Liverpool changed a hell of a lot of Anfield. Suddenly, you know, it was a support base that, a bit like a former smoker, a former smoker suddenly becomes the most evangelical of you know, of non-smokers. This is what Liverpool support became. You know, they went from being, you know, having a racist element to being kind of like the set of supporters that would shout it down and point it out. You know, I always remember that story of I think it was in the Kemlin stand, and someone sat behind a couple of old fellas, and it was at Derby County, one of the first home games of the season that Barnes had played, and he took the ball in his stride, turned, and he just burned them for pace. You know, it was one of the most beautiful pieces of skill. And two old fellas sat in front, and said, one had turned to the other and said, "Oh, he's maybe not as black as we thought he was." And it was just one of those of its generation. But it was just kind of like it left you completely dumbstruck, but in completely different ways. It was a horrendous thing to hear. But at the same time, what he'd done is, in one fell swoop, he'd made two old fellas from a certain generation think differently. You know, it had opened a door in the mind, and that's what it did. And this is what Ricky's generation of black players did. It made a lot of people think, and it created that schism that still exists today. You know, we only have to look at what's going on with social media, you know, and even on the pitch, still players are being abused by other players. You know, so it still exists today, but that it has now become two polar opposites, you know, and it's Ricky's generation that split that and pushed those two into different directions.
You know, to me, Ricky, this, you know, this story is it's so many different stories all in one book, which is what it makes it such a great book. But I, you know, the football side of it is obviously so important and is the common thread that links this whole story together. And that Luton Town side, you know, we need to talk about that Luton Town side and, you know, the rise of Luton Town that you were very much at the heart of. And there's, I suppose, there's sort of three or four moments or games that, you know, that I want to chat with you and ask you about. But could you, I'm always, you know, obviously I've never played professional football, never even come close to playing professional football, but I'm always interested, when you have a side like that sort of rises and rises, and, you know, you could maybe look at Wimbledon, you know, around the same time that rise and rise and rise and go on to the FA Cup, you have Watford at the same time. Did you, as a player, did you get a sense of what was happening? Did you get a sense of where this Luton Town side were going and how far they could go?
Of course, Duke. Can I just briefly just touch on something, Steve?
Of course, yeah,
was mentioning. It's just in regards to the, as you rightly say, bringing the race to the fore, trying to unify people in respects using the game as their kind of visual vehicle for them to see that black people are capable and not less capable than others. Also, during that era, the issue we also had was the acceptance initially to be given a platform to play, because there was a stereotypical comments that were coming out from the various members of the football fraternity regarding black players' temperaments, and we didn't like certain things, and we didn't like the cold weather, we couldn't head the ball. All false words, all ridiculous, but they were allowed to permeate throughout the system, and certain people who knew no different would believe them. So those are the obstacles that we had to try to beat down, the barriers that we had to knock out the ballpark. So eventually, and the first managers who have to have credit would be people like Ron Greenwood, Jimmy Cyril at Notts County, obviously Harry Haslam at Luton, who they saw the benefit of having black players or players that were good, irrespective of their colour. And just because they were black, it didn't make any difference to them. And obviously Ron Atkinson took the 3 degrees at West Brom, and so, and it became easier for other black players to be noticed, to be had to be given trials, to be given an opportunity. So, you know, that all went hand in hand. And from my perspective, I believe, looking back now, I've never really given it much thought, because as a footballer, you live for today, you move on for tomorrow. And as I say, I didn't really look too much in the past, and anything was kind of just the amnesia. But stylistically, I would suggest that I was one of the first black central midfield players, out and out, general type, Johnny Giles, you know, controlled the game, getting hoddle type, in the centre of midfield. There was always wingers, and there was always strikers, and there were always defenders. But actually someone who could be the computer of the team or be part of that clinical area that you do everything, there wasn't many black players, or if any. So I could have been one of the first to actually impose my career, whatever you want to call it, in that position at this moment in time. So in moving on to the Luton Town situation, I think it was the progression of Luton always had the values of attractive football. Harry Haslam, before David Pleat was a manager, also played with an outside left, 2 strikers, 3 in midfield. And then when David Pleat took over, he kept on the same formation. And David Pleat, I guess, would have gauged that from Brian Clough, because he was a big proponent and a big fan of Brian Clough. And he kind of used Brian Clough's philosophies in terms of, you know, stylistically, managerially, and also football, love of football and the games we played in the right manner. So when David took over in 78, immediately he saw a side that was at a number of aging players, and he felt he was a young coach and some of those players were not going to respect him in the manner that he needed them to respect him as a young, unproven manager. So he decided he's going to get rid of a few and bring in young, hungry players from lower leagues as well, give them an opportunity. And his recruitment was fantastic in that early part of 78, 79, 80, you know, the likes of Kirk Stevens came from non-Eton, non-league. Mark Hazelwood came from Newport as a 17-year-old. David Moss came from Swindon, in and around the peripheries. Bob Hatton came in, who was an older striker, but still would score 20 goals a year wherever he went. And David Pleat started to nurture. He found Brian Steen. I think Brian Steen came when Harry was here, just crossed over. Harry left a month afterwards. But Brian came from Edgware Town for 3,000. Mal Donaghy came from Larn for 20,000. So all these gems that David Pleat and his recruitment staff had found and brought into Luton and put together as a unit, it was an unbelievable time for us. And I think the biggest thing that came out during that period was his demand for us to play a certain brand of football, a certain style of football, always to think about trying to win the game, always try to score more than the opposition. And then I mentioned in my book, I never really played 4-4-2 in my whole career. And that's testimony to David Pleat. And I certainly didn't play 4-5-1 ever in my career. We may have played 1 sweeper, 2 markers, 4 in midfield, wing backs and 3 up front. But we always generally played with 3 offensive players, plus myself, who I consider to be an offensive player. So that would mean 4 of us were guaranteed to go out there and try to cause havoc. So, I mean, it was a great period for me to play in. It was below the top level. It was League 2, Division 2. But the gap and the chasm between League 1 and League 2 wasn't that great. There were some great sides in Division 2 at the time and some big sides that had got relegated from Division 1. And so I didn't really feel I was missing out on anything by being in Division 2. I was still developing my game, playing in a wonderful side with great players, great people, and I was still developing and, you know, obviously trying to get to the real top of the game.
Sorry, it's funny that you talked about trying to win games. And like I say, we spoke to Paul Power not so long ago, and I just want to just bring your career forward just a little bit, and that game against Manchester City. Now, Paul mentioned the absolute desolation in the changing rooms at Main Road, and just the somber quietness, I think was how he described it, wasn't it, Stephen? The sort of almost abject silence. But I guess now, because obviously we're reading about it in your book, and it was funny because we'd just done the Paul Power podcast, and then I happened to be reading your book the next evening. And I just wonder what your changing rooms were like following that game.
Euphoric is an understatement, Steve. You know, particularly in light of the fact that we were going to one of the giants of the game, irrespective of them being in Division 2. I mean, I grew up admiring Man City as a football club, as a team, legends like Colin Bell and, you know, Alan Pardew, not Pardew, Glenn Pardew at the back, and, you know, the Tony Book, the ex-manager and legend, and obviously Rodney Marsh and the likes. And that era where I played, Gary Owen and Peter Barnes were fantastic players. And, you know, we all looked at Man City and thought, what a great club, what a big club, and went into the Lions' den, so to speak, where, you know, 40,000 Man City fans, 6,000 Luton fans, they only have to draw, and we have to win. Now, I guess from the perspective of, did we expect to win? I think we never went in there with any real fear. One thing about playing for David Pleat during that era was we were expected to go and try to win. And I think I mentioned in the book that we got some humbling defeats at Anfield, Steve. We were 5-0 down at half-time, one era. And they weren't even
I remember that one.
And we weren't even kicking towards a cop at that time. We were kicking towards the other end. So we feared the worst at half-time. And there was no mention of shoring up the defence. There was no mention of just dropping out, leave one up front. It was just like, just go and play, so we can get back into the game. So we got away, I think it was 6-0 eventually. But yeah, we were glad to take that. So going to Man City, likewise, we're thinking, okay, yeah, we like this. I think we were quite good at cup competitions. We'd back ourselves with the quality of players that we had, someone like Paul Walsh and Brian Steen, you know, who were very multi-talented, that could cause havoc, could beat people, could score goals, weren't dependent just on individuals making chances for them. They were good all-round players as well. And they had Trevor Aylott, likewise, who was a really competent centre-forward. So we knew we always had a chance, a puncher's chance within the game. And yes, it was edgy, but it was real. The atmosphere was electric. It was one of those games that right now I still think about now, transport myself back into there and think, yeah, how, you know, to think that we came out on the right end of the result was brilliant. At the end of the game, there's a bit of argy-bargy going on between the two dressing rooms, but I missed it. I could just hear shouting from our lads here, go in the dressing room. I think there was unsavory words that were spoken, and we were saying, well, get down, see you later, have a good day, you know. We're still in the kind of first division at the time. But, you know, I was not part to that, because I've always, from that premise of, yeah, someone has to win, someone has to lose.
Stephen, it's one of those iconic games, isn't it? Like you say, that, you know, from the moment of, yep, you know, Rani Antic is the scorer, it's John Watson's commentary, it's David Pleat running across the pitch, and obviously Paul Parra had plenty to say about that. but it is, like you say, football was on the television so little. You know, and so, you know, as much as I suppose, you know, and clearly Ricky thinks about the game and he played in it, but when you look back as a child, you know, that's just one of those games that we were fortunate to get highlights and images of, and so therefore it really sticks in the mind.
It does. It was such a seismic thing as well. I mean, I think we're a year on from Leeds United being relegated. You know, in the 70s, Man United and Spurs had gone down. So, you know, that concept, Chelsea, I think, twice as well. You know, that concept of the big club, you know, not being kind of like infallible, you know, they're not immune to this situation. And I think they've been in mid-table with about 10, 12 games to go, and then sacked John Bond, and then suddenly they just dropped like a stone. And they felt this, almost this kind of like, I don't know, a comeuppance to it, as if they, you know, it was something of their own making. And then for Luton to come along and have this, like Ricky said, a puncher's chance. It's exactly, you know, it's the perfect phrase for it. It's exactly what it was. And then, you know, that esoteric edge to it by the fact that it's Rade Antic, this Yugoslavian who hits the winning goal. You know, an absolute rarity still in the English game at that time for a foreign player. You know, so, you know, there was just so much. And then, yeah, David Pleat's there, you know, hopping and skipping across the pitch. And it was just one of the most, I think as a Liverpool fan, I'd say I've always classed myself as being a, you know, a football fan in general as well from a very early age. And I always remember, you know, my point of genesis being when Liverpool played Norwich at Carrow Road, and it ended 5-3, and a flame heard David Fairclough scored a hat-trick, which stood out for me because I had that Duracell look as well back then. And then there's kind of like, you know, Justin Fashanu scoring this goal that I just kind of like thought was absolutely fantastic. So for me, it was kind of like, yes, I support Liverpool, but, you know, so much about football is brilliance. You know, it's not just about my team. And this game, this loot and smash and grab game, just properly ticked every box.
Like I say, when we're doing these, Ricky, I find myself that I can't miss opportunities to ask questions about things that I've always wanted to know since I was a kid. And one of them, and obviously this is not such a momentous and happy occasion, but the Luton Millwall Cup tie. And again, you know, we talk about defining images, and David Pleat is a defining image running across that pitch. However, there were other defining images, and you know, the cup game, the seats, that apparent momentary loss of control by the police, you know, the orange seating that's just raining down, and you know, and I've never got to speak to anybody who was there. I've certainly never spoken to players who were involved in that game. But what are your recollections of the atmosphere, the leading up to, the aftermath around the club of that particular game?
It was crazy because really and truly, there was, when we got to the ground to do the warm-up and whatever else, to go to the dressing rooms, there was no sign of what was to come in the next hour and a half. But by the time we'd gotten changed and come out to the pitch to do our warm-up, we looked across, and as you come out of the tunnel, across from us is the Bobber Stand. And it was a nice family enclosure that went all the way along the length of the field. And it had probably six rows of chairs, a small roof over the top, but it were family season ticket holders generally. And we looked across as we went and came out, and all we saw was people within the stand standing up, being rowdy, seats flying onto the pitch, and the police cordon over that sign. We thought, crikey, there was no sign of any family there whose seats they would normally be. And it was just, and that's when it really dawned on me that this thing, wow, something terrible is going to happen today. The police had controlled that corner. It was probably around 30 yards width-wise off the stand. But from the to the right is the away supporters, Kenilworth Road stand. And that was open-ended, no roof over the top, and a gate cage over it. And that had a swelling on there already, which was far more than what we were used to. The bodies were just piled there, waiting, swearing, carrying on, just a very volatile situation. We managed to get through the warm-up. We went back in. We came out for the game, and it was still tense. It calmed down slightly. But behind the goal, the crowd had gotten even more. The swell had started even more. And they were now piling onto the pitch, to the edge of the pitch. So the police reinforcements must have come along, and they put a cordon on the outside of the pitch to stop the fans from getting towards the actual playing area. At the same time, things were kicking off in the state, in the main stand. That other part, the Bobber Stand, was already controlled by whichever fans were there. And there was fractions of fighting going on everywhere. But the referee decided he's still going to play. The atmosphere was so tense, and you could cut it with a, you know, it's like electric shock. I have to say that even though we were there to play football, our major concern was what was going on in the stands and beyond, because a lot of us had friends and family that were at the game. We were fairly safe. We had the police cordon all around us, and we were in the middle of the pitch. But those in the stands were exposed to whatever violence was taking place. It got to a point where the police couldn't contain them. And after 15 minutes, they decided we had to come off the field. And I didn't think we were going to go back out, because I didn't see there was any way that they could control the crowd and the game would then commence again. We were in the dressing room for about 20 minutes, 25 minutes. And as a footballer, the last thing you want to do is have a warm-up, start the game, play 15 minutes, and then come off and then lose your rhythm and have to start all over again in 25 or 30 minutes or an hour's time. But that's exactly what we had to do. So we went back out. The police had managed to control things slightly, although fighting was still taking place in various areas of the ground. We didn't think the game would finish. We managed to get our noses ahead with Brian taking a goal just before half time. It wasn't one of the memorable performances from us, I would say, in terms of stylistically. But we dug in and we competed well. And you know, everything that was going on that was detracting us from our game, we managed to see things out, not looking in any real danger defensively, to concede. And we held on to that 1-0 victory. And right before the end of the game, the referee said to You know, said, I'm going to blow up early, but make sure as I blow, you get off the pitch as sharp as you can. And I always remember that the referee, as he's about to blow his whistle, Brian Steen was on the far side of the pitch for some reason. And he blew the whistle. And one of the iconic pieces of footage that you see, and the guy's like, Brian Steen legging it off the field, and these supporters jumping, having jumped on the fence and chasing after him to get up there. And it was that tense. And you thought, well, when you got in the dressing room, you thought, he said, so what was all that about? You know, is this really what football is about? You know, and went to the players' bar afterwards and we saw the carnage, certain friends that we had, they'd been in fights and whatever else. And it was just one of those nights where it was a shame on football. I think we were the only game played that night. And apparently all the crews from London got together to come up to Luton. And they said they were going to destroy the town and destroy the club. And they all kind of ganged up. Chelsea, Arsenal, whoever else it was. And they burst through the gates at the Kenilworth Road end, didn't pay at the turnstile, burst through the gates and just flooded in, by all accounts.
I mean, Aidan, it's, you know, we sort of mentioned at the beginning about how this book is, and this is exactly the sort of thing I mean. You know, this book is a real social study of the English game in all its beauty and all its horror, in equal measure, I think is probably fair to say.
And certainly at this time, I mean, to add extra to what was going on at this time, obviously this is the spring of 1985. So, you know, around this time there was riots at Birmingham Leeds game. There was the Bradford fire. Then, of course, there was Heysel only a month or two later. You know, the FA made statements after this Millwall game, just saying that this would cost England the chance to host Euro 88 and things like that, which is just, you know, it's one of a number of incidents that were going on. And then, of course, that leads into the whole ID card scheme of the Thatcher government, an ill-fated plan, of course, and the UEFA ban, of course, that came in following Heysel a month or two later. But it's all just the whole factors that just added together the problem that English football had had with hooliganism. It had been, you know, this wasn't new. It had been there through the, to this extent, through the late 70s and early 80s. But I think it was coming to some sort of tipping point, that this was one sorry incident but it was one sorry incident of a number at that time. When I was reading a report earlier today, just obviously getting prepared for talking with Ricky and knowing that he was at the heart of some of these incidents, in the nicest possible way, at the heart of it, just you were playing rather than anything else. and it was described as the day that, you know, the night that football died a slow death, in one newspaper report. You know, nobody died on that occasion, but that's probably just more through luck than anything else. But people did die quite soon after in other serious incidents. But it was all wrapped up in the same time. This was all just within a couple of months from this to Heysel, and a number of incidents in between. So, you know, it's dark days, really dark days. And we, in our generation, look back at football in the 80s with joy. And, you know, on the field, it was joy, as Stephen talked about it earlier, the sort of the glow we look back on that era of, and the fun times. And, you know, we talked about that Man City game, and Ricky was at the heart of all sorts of major incidents in Luton's history of that Man City game. But then there's this moment, but, you know, that's followed up a few weeks later with the actual beauty of Ricky's wonderful goal in the cup semi-final against Everton. You know, sadly you didn't win on that day, but, you know, what a moment that was against the world's best goalkeeper at the time. I think it's probably safe to say. And you know, going forward, you're at the heart of Luton's finest ever success a couple of years later. But, you know, this was a less positive memory, but, you know, it's all part of the social history of the time. This isn't a football thing, in the same way that racism isn't a football thing. It shines a light on it, and it probably exposes it to more people than it would do normally, which is, you know, can be seen as a negative if you choose to, because it's making it front and center. But equally, that is a positive because it makes people talk about it and think about it. But hooliganism, I guess it was similar. Football wasn't, you know, hooliganism wasn't a football problem. It was a societal problem. There was a lot of disgruntlement. There was a lot of unrest You know, there'd been social issues, miner strikes, and then you, going forward into the 80s, there's all the poll tax things. You know, there was a lot of unrest, a lot of change going on in the country, and football, unfortunately, became the conduit where through the prism through which this was reflected. And, you know, for the people caught up in it, Ricky and Brian Steen on the wrong side of the pitch, it must have been terrifying at times. It really must. To add in, especially for, as we talked already, the racism element, you know, to add that in when you've got people rioting and coming onto the pitch, I mean, who knows what would have happened? What were their intentions? Was it just to, and as Ricky said, there were fans of Chelsea, West Ham, whoever else were there just to cause trouble. But were their intentions just to cause trouble, or was it to do something far worse than that? And that, you know, that could have been playing on people's minds, and that was a real fear. So, you know, it is part of the social history of the country and part of the social history of the time, played out on the football fields in one way or another. But, you know, that makes it a really compelling thing to learn about and see, and or in our case, to recall. Because, you know, I remember the images very, very clearly of those seats being flung across and people come onto the pitch, and it was terrifying to me as a young lad, and it hardened my mum's desire for me to never go to a game with Millwall in it, whenever if they came up our way in Newcastle. But you know, she would always ask, "Who's the opposition, and do they have bad fans?" And that's a sad thing, but that's where it was at the time.
It is. And like I say, you know, Ricky, you've been at, you know, sort of the forefront of so many things in what is our generation, our favourite generation of football, you know, good times and bad times. Aidan mentioned there about the Everton semi-final. And like I say, we have a guy called Paul McParland, who is, he's the most passionate Everton fan I think I've ever met, with the most amazing recall that I've ever heard. And we were chatting the other day, and when we told him, you know, we got you coming on, and he asked me to ask you specifically, was there a particular grudge between the Luton Town players and the Everton players? Because as an Everton fan, he always got the impression that there was a little bit of extra needle between the two between the two sides or the two sets of players.
I don't think there was any needle with the players off the field, Stuart. But okay, once we got on the field, there was serious needle between the two teams. And I think for some reason, I think we always played fairly well against Everton. Everton were the top side at that time. They were rolling people over regularly. But for whatever reason, whether it was the characters we had allied with the ability that we had in our team, we were one of those teams that we would just lie down and be rolled over. We had Steve Foster and Mick Harford and, you know, warriors like that in the side. And we had Brian Steen up front and David Moss and myself and now Donaghy and, you know, Paul Elliott before he moved on. We had some tough personalities and who weren't frightened to face a challenge. And I think where Everton were concerned, they were not weary of us. They were very respectful for us. And they knew that they would generally have to come with their A game in order to turn us over and get the right result for them. And that semi-final game was a point in case whereby, you know, I write in the book that we had five apprentices, former apprentices playing for Luton at that time. It was Tim Breaker at right back. There was Gary Parker at right midfield. There was myself at centre midfield. There was Wayne Turner at left midfield. There was Mitchell Thomas at left back. And on top of that, we had Emeka Nwajobi, who came from university at 24. We had Brian Steen that came for 3,000. We had Mal Donaghy for 20,000 from Lahn. So really and truly, man for man, we should not have been able to compete with the great Everton of that era. But we did compete and we outplayed them totally on that game. And, you know, I don't know if Paul would or you probably recall how fortunate they were to get the right result at the end of the day. But I broke my leg, interestingly enough, at Everton post that semi-final game and in the season when we won the Littlewoods Cup against Arsenal. And that game was hell for leather. There was certainly needle going on. And it was an atmosphere whereby 20 minutes, no one could get the ball down. It was just competing, competing, competing. And I decided after 20 minutes, the ball's come to me, I'm going to take a touch and I'm going to have a dribble. And I took a touch, dribbled, I went to make a pass. And I paused. And as I paused, I realised the person in front of me, he's going to be offside. So then I went to touch the ball and continue my dribble. And Peter Reid had come on the blind side of me, swept through, slid through, but the ball wasn't there. Now it was my leg. And he took my leg, wrapped one leg around the other leg, and my leg was in the middle of his. His body had swept off the touchline, and I rotated and a spiral fracture. I was off. Anyway, by all accounts, after that, Mick Harford, it did kick off. Mick Harford butted Kevin Ratcliffe. I think there was a few little more skirmishes that took place. We lost 2-0. It was a league game. But I know that, you know, the boys were really disappointing with the manner of the tackle that happened on me. And it wasn't even given a free kick, by the way. It was just a throw in or something. And from there, I think we always had that rivalry. And I remember getting stamped on at Everton again, off the ball, when the ball was somewhere else by one of their players. And I didn't know who it was, but foot came down on my face. I was on the ground and I had a stud mark on my eye and my lip was cut. And Brian Steen came down and said, so-and-so tried to do you. I mean, in this day and age, with the TV cameras what they are, I mean, certain people would have been banned for a lot longer than 3 or 10 games with some of the stuff that was going on back in those times. But, you know, for us, it was, we compete, let's try to win the game at all costs. And I guess Paul's right in regards to that little bit of extra edge. I think the edge for us came because Everton were the best around that era. And we wanted to prove that we could compete with them and we could beat them on any given day. And I think that's what kind of spurred us on. Likewise in Liverpool, likewise with Arsenal, likewise with Tottenham, the so-called, I put inverted commas, big sides. I think we always wanted to raise our game for those moments in particular.
I'm going to put Paul straight, Ricky. I'm going to tell him it was dirty Everton, and that you refused to be bullied by them. And I'm going to tell him that.
Absolutely, tell him that.
Sure. I'm going to. Obviously, the next or the sort of final game that I want to come to while you're at Luton, and that is, for me, you know, you talk about great FA Cup finals, great European Cup finals, great World Cup finals. For me, it's the best League Cup final I've ever seen. It's the League Cup final that defines that competition for me. Stephen will have other ones because he'll have loads to choose from when he won it, but that just gets boring. So we can pick ones for entertainment value. Again, like I say, I certainly don't get to speak to people, you know, who've played at Wembley, who've won, you know, major trophies, you know, who've been involved in, you know, classic games that people can recall instantly. And usually my question is usually just sort of just tell me about it. just what was it like?
Well, it was kind of, you know, the culmination of 13 years at Luton. You know, I was the longest serving player there. I'd come through the ranks, as you know, and become an England international by playing for Luton. But we'd never got to a major cup final. And my love for football begun at that moment when I witnessed Albert Johansson in the lineup, going to be shaking hands with the Liverpool teams, the Liverpool team and the dignitaries that were there for the Liverpool Leeds FA Cup final 1965. And I kind of transported my body into his because he looked like me. He was a black player. I'd never seen a black player. And I was a little kid. I didn't even know what these teams were. And I asked my brother, what team's that? He said, Leeds United. I said, okay, that's my team. So I've always supported Leeds, even now. And so for me then, to emulate what Mr. Johansson had done, you know, some 23 years later, now I'm at Wembley, albeit it's not an FA Cup final, but I'm out there for a cup final. And hopefully I can then inspire someone else who's watching the telly for the first time. And they say, who's that team? Luton Town. Okay, I'm going to support Luton Town. But more than that, I broken my leg, as I just alluded to, on Boxing Day at Goodison Park. And we had a great run in all the cup competitions. We got to the Simrod Cup final. We got to the semi-final of the FA Cup. And I'd missed those two games. And they were 2 weeks before the actual final against Arsenal, the Littlewoods Cup final. But I wasn't ready to come back from the broken leg and the damaged ankle ligaments. So just imagine, I'm sitting there, longest serving player at Luton, missing out on those big occasions, a Wembley trip against Reading, albeit we lost that game. I'm praying that I'm going to be fit enough to play a part of some description within this Arsenal game. And just before the final, Darren McDonagh became injured. He got a knee injury, anterior cruciate injury. And it was hard luck for Darren, but it opened up a place whereby I may not have been risked and I may not have been included in Ray Harford's thoughts, but all of a sudden there was a place in midfield that became open. And I thought, well, okay, there's an opportunity for me here. I played one reserved game or behind closed doors game against Crystal Palace. I was still having treatment on my ankle every day. My ankle was still really badly swollen, still had to have strapping on it. But I thought, I'm going to put myself available for selection. So from that perspective, I was delighted to be there. I was not anywhere near, what did I say, 100% of what my capabilities are. And I tuned my mind to say, well, okay, I know you like to do certain things in the game and stylistically, but just play sensibly. Just keep the ball moving. Don't get caught in possession. Don't try to do anything extravagant. Just play a simple game well. Do things quickly and early. And I just held the right side of the field and was involved in the game. And the atmosphere was fantastic. The day was wonderful in terms of being sunny and bright. Brunt is my home ground where we were raised. I lived 3.5 miles from Wembley. So all these factors were important to say, well, here I am at Wembley Stadium in a cup final. And then to go with the team and to have the game that we had, whereby the ups and downs and the ebbs and flows, whereby we're looking safe in the game, we score first, we're looking great, Arsenal not causing any problem. Next thing we know, we're 2-1 down within 3 minutes. Then there's a penalty, and we think, okay, good night. You know, it's all over now. And Andy Dibble says it, and we go, okay. Then we go to the last 10 minutes, and Mark Steen comes on, and Gus Caesar falls over, and Danny Wilson scores a goal. And what? 2-2. Don't know how long's left. And then Ashley Grimes finds himself on the right wing and crosses with his left foot from a half-cleared free kick. And Brian finishes with aplomb as always. And I didn't realise that the time was up. So we're 3-2 up now. Everyone's going crazy. We're just trying to stay calm. We don't know how long's left. And I've gone back towards the centre circle for the kickoff. And I've said to the referee, how long is there to go? He said, it's over. And what? I couldn't believe it, you know? And, you know, for the mere fact that I was able to contribute for the 90 minutes, albeit not at my, what I would like to consider, the standard I would like to have played in a cup final, but I was there with my teammates urging on, and I think collectively it was the most wonderful occasion for us to experience as a group of players.
I mean, you know, Stephen, you'll you'll have your own opinions about League Cup finals and memories, and that's fine. It must be boring for you as a Liverpool fan. However, as a neutral, as neither a Luton nor Arsenal fan, like we say, it is one of those great games. And as Ricky sort of gone through, you know, a game where the lead changes hands sort of three times, it's a saved penalty, you know, last minute goals. It's everything the neutral and Luton Town fans clearly want from a cup final.
Oh, it's the best League Cup final ever, certainly my lifetime. You know, it was a wonderful, wonderful game. As Ricky said, it was played out in, you know, glorious sunshine. And this was an era where the League Cup final took place in kind of late April, about three weeks or so before the FA Cup final. So, you know, it was always very different, kind of like how it is when it's played at the end of February. It's dank, it's miserable. And when Wembley, the old Wembley, if you went, you know, could be a bit rustic. But when you watched it on the television in its glorious splendour, and then, you know, it had the shadows cast across the pitch of the roofs, the stands and all of that, it was just this magical place, pitched like a carpet, and the whole, it looked the part, it looked its Sunday best. And this game was just it was marvellous. It really, really was. And I think Luton were in poor form, poor set of results going into the game. So in a way, the pressure was off. All the pressure was on Arsenal. They'd not won anything, you know, since 1979. You know, so it was all about, you know, could Arsenal see it through? You know, so Luton had lost this Simog Cup final, lost this FA Cup final. You know, suddenly kind of the pressure's off. Yes, it's got to be rough to lose three such, you know, huge games. You know, would be a hell of a kick. But at the same time, once you've lost two, then, you know, if you lose a third, then so what? But then there was like the Mark Steen incident that he didn't get selected, and Kingsley Black came in, and, you know, it was also, and then it's like, you know, Nigel Winterburn playing at right back when he's left back. And it just all kind of like fell into place. And then Luton had played so well at 1-0. And then this, like Ricky said, this wild few minutes where Arsenal kind of like seized the lead. I think, Martin Hayes came on and made a massive difference, and suddenly it was kind of like Arsenal switched themselves on. Then this penalty, and Andy Dibble made a, it wasn't just that penalty he saved, it was a succession of saves that he made. I seem to remember him tipping one up onto the crossbar that seemed an impossible save, which was kind of like just before Luton equalised. And then once Luton equalised, suddenly Arsenal went rabbit in the headlights. And it was just a game that had absolutely everything. Just as you're gearing up for extra time, thinking, great, another 30 minutes of this, I'll take that. There was Brian Steen with this you know, wonderful, dramatic winner. And it was just kind of like an awe-inspiring game. And then you just sat there in the Glover. And then we went out and tried to replicate it in the streets.
As you do after every great cup final.
And then that's it. You know, Ricky's Panini sticker suddenly got even more valuable.
Obviously, we want to chat to you about you know, management and, you know, your management career and coaching career, and certainly your opinions on that. And there's a brilliant but heartbreaking quote in the book that I want to come to. I highlighted it as soon as I'd read it. But before then, just a little bit on playing for England, Ricky. Again, you know, it's, you know, you talk about you know, ambition and wanting to achieve as much as you can. You know, and I think fourth black player to play for England. Yeah.
Yes.
And again, that's probably my my ignorance or my lack of knowledge. But again, I didn't realise that, you know, that you were such a, you know, literally, again, one of the trailblazers, the pioneers in terms of black players for England.
Oh, absolutely, Stuart. I guess where I might have slipped slightly under the radar, although I always had a reasonable profile, shall we say, being Luton Town, being an attacking side, you know, playing the way I did, was the fact that we weren't in the Premier League or the equivalent of Premier League. We were in the second division. So the mass supporter base throughout the country might have known about Luton. They would have admired their team, but they wouldn't have realised, you know, a great deal of to how we played or stylistically how good we really were. But Sir Bobby Robson, where it was fortunate for me, was an admirer. Ipswich were up there, similarly to what Everton were doing a couple of years later, the European Cup Winners' Cup, second in the league, you know, great players, Walk and Gates, Murin, Tyson Murin and Murin and Tyson and George Burley and the likes. But Sir Bobby took over the England manager's position, and in his very first squad, he selected me in his very first squad. And we just got promotion from the old second division into the first division. I hadn't even played in the first division yet, not even one game. But Sir Bobby had seen enough of me during his travels and playing against him in the cup ties from 18 years old. Apparently, he'd always said to David Pleat, when are you going to sell me your boy Hill? So he was a big admirer. And he showed that to me by the fact that he inserted me into the squad. I came off the bench from my first game in the European Championships in Denmark, and we drew 2-2 in that game. And Jesper Olsen scored 2 and Trevor Francis scored 2. And then the following month, we played West Germany at home, and Sir Bobby gave me the greatest recognition and honour of my career and the individual accolade by selecting me to start against West Germany at Wembley. Interestingly enough, before the game that morning, he said to me, Ricky, I do understand that you don't play right side of midfield for your team. But Bobby preferred the 4-4-2 formation. And he preferred wide players that went up and down, not in a straight line, but they kick the width and go down and cross balls like Stevie Coppell and Mark Chamberlain, afterwards Trevor Stevens, and that type of player. On the other side, it would be Graham Ricks or Alan Kirby, Alan Devonshire or Peter Barnes. But I was a kind of in-to-out right-sided midfielder, played that in a three-man midfield. But so Bobby said to me, Ricky, I realise you don't play that position, but you can do a job for me there, can't you? In a wide of a four. I said, of course, Sir Bobby, I'd love the opportunity. So I played in that position, which was the first time I'd ever played there in my career anyway. And I felt I equipped myself fairly well on the night. And, you know, with those five of us that made our debuts, and I think we all did okay on the night, albeit the result didn't go for us. And I remained in the squad thereafterwards for that whole of that season. I was disappointed not to have played more in terms of giving more opportunities to play, because I felt my performance against Swiss Germany had warranted more of a look to establish myself. But again, I think stylistically, my position might have been something of a conundrum for Sir Bobby as to where would he play me if he's going to have to change his preferred formation or put me as one of the two central midfielders, which again, I grew up playing in as a central midfielder, not a right midfielder or an inside right midfielder. So it wouldn't have been an issue to me, but perhaps Sir Bobby didn't realise that or didn't trust me enough to play him in that position.
Aidan, it's there's two, I suppose, two things here that merit discussion. One, you know, we talk about the 1982 World Cup. You know, it sits well with us in our memories, and yet, you know, here we are with only the fourth black player to play for England. You know, and it's in our lifetime. You know, and I've said before, the students that I teach really struggle, which is a good thing in a way, but struggle to comprehend that. They really struggle to wrap their heads around the fact that in my lifetime, literally my lifetime, that there hadn't been a black player for England. So there's that. But then also, and you know, Ricky's talking there about an international manager or an England manager who was willing to pick players on ability and not the club that they were at. You know, if you imagine now, so, you know, Gareth Southgate taking someone from, I suppose it would be Norwich or Watford, or, you know, and inserting them into an England squad, starting against West Germany, who would go on to play in the final of that 82 World Cup. You know, in a World Cup year, you know, all of this just is of different times, is what I'm trying to say. And yet it's our lifetime.
Yeah, it is very, very different, isn't it? And I guess comparing it to now, I guess the bigger clubs have a greater array of talent, you know, bigger squads and so on. So I guess maybe the talent was spread around a bit better in those days, and therefore players coming up from the Championship, you know, there wasn't the huge disparity. You come up from the Championship in a team, the Championship, Division 2 as it was back then. You come up from Division 2 to Division 1, and, you know, teams would regularly make a fairly strong fist of things in the top division. That the huge disparity wasn't there. Whereas now, you know, it's all about struggling to survive at the bottom, except for, well, various exceptions, but not too many. So I guess that's a bit of a difference. But it does seem worlds away. But, you know, Sir Bobby Robson, somebody I hold dear, obviously, as a Newcastle fan. He's a great legend up here too. So it's good to hear Ricky's words about him as well. Because, I mean, at that time, when Bobby Robson will have been under huge pressure at that point. You know, this is his very first game. It's a competitive match away against a Denmark side that, you know, maybe in England we weren't really paying attention to how good Denmark were about to become. But they were a good team. They had really good players, and they were really building. And they showed in that game how good they were. And they demonstrated it even more when they came back to Wembley the following year. But, you know, Bobby Robson will have been under intense pressure to perform well. It's the first game of the European Championship qualifiers. It's a vital game away against a key rival. So to pick Ricky in the squad and then to bring him on in that game is must have been a huge, huge boost of confidence, a huge personal boost for you, Ricky, to be in that. To then go to start soon after against West Germany and so on, and to be involved going forwards. I mean, that I think you're probably right in terms of positionally. Bobby Robson was more rigid and set in certain ways in those days, wasn't he? That, you know, he gradually got out of maybe 20 odd years later on. But it had to fit into the system. So yeah, possibly Ricky's right. That played against him when it comes to more caps and so on. But the recognition was obviously still there of the talent and the ability. And that, you know, regardless of how many caps the player ends up with, that can't be taken away. That can't be removed. You know, that's there. And to the other point on the black players playing for England, it's just something that you don't even notice now. And that's a real positive. But going back nearly 40 years, we're talking now to when Ricky made his debut, to be the fourth black player that still will have warranted attention at the time, you know, justified or not, it will have done. Not the attention that Viv Anderson had to deal with, of course, as the very first, but that wasn't very long before. So it was still a novelty. It was still a new thing. nowadays you don't even notice that it's white players, black players. It's just good players, and that's how you think of it. And that's a long road. It's been to that. It's been a slow and winding path, I think, to get to that point. But I think, in terms of the discussion about national recognition, England players, and so on, I think. It's colorblind now in that aspect. I honestly do. Hopefully Ricky feels the same, because I think, you know, players are judged and talked about and discussed. I mean, you know, obviously the manager judged on talent anyway, but, you know, I mean, general perception, fans, media, the likes. It's purely about talent. It's colorblind. There's no sort of, you know, if England put out a team that was entirely black, you know, I don't think it would be notable, absolutely. But would anyone say, well, why? Because it would be talented players that they're being chosen on merit, and absolutely, why not? But, you know, there is simply no discussion now, and that's a great thing, but it's taken a long time to get to. So yes, in our lifetimes, for it to be so utterly different is, to our modern eyes now, really hard to comprehend. But yes, that is indeed how it was. It's been a long road, but I think on that aspect, and I know coaching is a whole different thing, but in terms of the players, that's been a huge, huge progression.
It's a great link, Aidan. It's like we do this all the time.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.